Welcome to The Red-Haired Archaeologist. I am your host, author, and sunscreen advocate, Amanda Hope Haley. Thank you for spending some time with me today, studying artifacts our Near Eastern ancestors left behind, and considering if those items just might change how we read or read into scripture. To summarize the last 11 episodes of this season, I would say ancient Egypt was a unique and glorious culture and empire for thousands of years until they were conquered by the same external empires who took over Israel. They fell to Persia, who then fell to Greece, and then Rome, and then Rome became the Christian Byzantine Empire, and then after that came the Arab Muslims. And that's who we'll be talking about today. Each conquest took a little more of ancient Egypt's culture away from her people until that very particular culture, the worship of those gods, the way that they wrote, the way that they built, all of those little bits of their culture disappeared almost entirely. One of my struggles in preparing this season of the podcast has really been in editing. Egypt has a long and especially complex history, and I feel like I, sitting at my desk, have been drinking from the proverbial fire hose every single week as I've been preparing these episodes. I hope that you haven't felt the same way, at least not all the time, when you've been listening. I've done my best to limit the dates and limit the names and just give you a broad overview, something that is basically a primer on Egyptian history. Today's topic for me is another fire hose moment, because today we aren't just talking about any old empire, but we're talking about 1300 years of an empire and a religion that still exists today. That, of course, is Islam. So in 610, Egypt was still a part of the Byzantine Empire, and a 40-year-old man named Muhammad was living in a city called Mecca. And Mecca was a hub of polytheistic religion. He began receiving revelations from an angel named Gabriel. Those revelations would eventually all be recorded into a book called the Quran. Once he started receiving these revelations, he began preaching to the people around him in Mecca that God is one. And because Mecca was such a polytheistic city, they weren't really fans of this new message. And so they started persecuting Muhammad, and he fled south to a city called Medina. There, he converted others to follow this religion where God is one. He formed an army of about 10,000. In 629, he marched back to Mecca and he conquered it. By the time of his death in 632, most of the Arabian Peninsula had not only been converted to Islam, but were living under his rule. So if you're counting, then that means that within only 22 years, he founded a new religion, he conquered a pretty large landmass, and he converted many, many people. When he died, chaos erupted because there wasn't a clear line of succession for the religion or for the growing empire. As future leaders would come to power, they were often members of the military, generals, or maybe descendants from Muhammad or people who had married into his family. As different people would rise to power and inherit the title of caliph, which means the ruler of the caliphate and also the head of the religion. As these caliphs would come to power, they would inevitably be killed. And in 656, a civil war broke out. That resulted in two branches of Islam, which you've probably heard of, one being Sunni and one being Shia. Before that civil war broke out, between 639 and 654, the Byzantine Empire was warring with the first caliphate. They were called the Rashidun Caliphate. And the two of them were warring over Egypt until finally the Byzantine fleet was defeated at Alexandria. The caliphate conquered Egypt, they conquered Israel, and eventually two-thirds of the entire Byzantine Empire. Well, you might expect that in Egypt, the Coptic Christians would have been on the side of their Christian Byzantine rulers, as we talked about last week. But many of the Coptic Christians thought that the Muslims were actually more tolerant of their particular form of Christianity than even the Byzantines had been, because the Byzantine Christians wanted everyone to worship in the same way that they did. And the Coptic Christians had some unique ways of worshiping that were specific to Egypt and to the experiences that they had had over the previous hundreds of years. When the Rashidun Caliphate came in, they made provisions for people who were not Muslims. The cops were told that if they paid tribute money, if they agreed to provide food for any Muslim soldiers who were there in the area where they were living, then they would be excused from military service. They would be left free to worship as they wanted to worship, and they could even administer their own affairs. Over time, a lot of Christians and even Jews who were living in Egypt at the time converted to Islam. Maybe they did it because of ease. Maybe they did it because it was cheaper. Maybe they did it out of fear. But over time, that started to happen, and the Christian and Jewish groups that were living in Egypt became smaller as people converted. Those who didn't, those who chose to continue to be Christian or to be Jewish, they received what was a sort of protected status, and they were told they had to pay higher taxes than everybody else who was around them who were Muslim, but they were still allowed to follow their own religions as long as their laws did not contradict Islamic law. Well, over the next 300 or so years, the caliphates would turn over. There would be wars within themselves, and different people would rise to power. And throughout this, the treatment of non-Muslims consistently became harsher. Always these people were paying higher taxes. Always these people had fewer rights. But eventually those rights really began to erode, and churches and synagogues, suddenly they were no longer allowed to be built. They were no longer even allowed to be repaired. Non-Muslims were told that they could not live in houses that had elevations that were higher than their Muslim neighbors. No religious symbols could be seen in public. So no crosses, no Stars of David, nothing representing any religion other than Islam could be seen in public. And even their forms of worship had to be quiet. You couldn't have very, very loud praise. In 973, a new dynasty came in to Egypt, not just to Egypt, but to the region at large, and that was the Fatimid dynasty. These people claimed descent from Fatima, who was Muhammad's daughter. They were Shia. They built an empire that was centered in Egypt, and this empire that they built would last for almost 200 years. While they were there, it was a time of growth for Egypt and the empire as a whole. The empire itself would grow to include all of North Africa. It would include the Levant and include Jerusalem as part of that. It would even reach out into the Mediterranean and take the island of Sicily. This dynasty, they traded throughout the Mediterranean Sea. They traded as far as the Indian Ocean, through the Indian Ocean. They even reached into China. And their territorial, diplomatic, and economic advances were so profound, they ended up laying a very strong foundation for what was to come next for Egypt, for what would be the next big Egyptian dynasty that would be founded by someone you've probably heard of, and his name was Saladin. And Saladin would come in 1173. Before Saladin, while Egypt was really growing under the Fatimid Empire, the Byzantine Empire was starting to be attacked by Sunni Islamic kingdoms. The Byzantine Empire, which had broken from Rome at this point, the emperor wrote to the Pope, who would have been the head of the Western Church, and he asked him for help against the Turks, who were starting to invade and press in on the Byzantine Empire. So in 1095, Pope Urban, who was the head of the Western Church in Rome, asked all of the Western Christian countries to send troops to help push back the Muslims and to regain control of Jerusalem. Everyone agreed pretty enthusiastically. This began the Crusades. And of course, the Crusades, which I'm sure you know about, they would continue for 200 years. At first, Egypt wasn't really a consideration for the Christians and the Muslims as they were warring over Jerusalem, with the big caveat that Jerusalem at this point is part of the Fatimid Empire. The Fatimids, who were centralized and ruling from Egypt, they had to protect all of their holdings in the Levantine region. They had to protect Jerusalem. And so they were putting their attention there. They were sending troops up to fight. But Egypt itself wasn't being invaded. That changed about 100 years later in 1164. At that point, because of the Crusades, there was actually a Christian king in Jerusalem, and he decided to go into Egypt. At the same time, a Sunni king of Kurdish descent also decided to go into Egypt. This event led to the rise of Saladin, and he would become the first sultan of Egypt. under Saladin and under all the people who would follow him, Egypt became the dominant Sunni political and military force. It became an economic and cultural center of the entire region for over 300 years. Throughout those 300 years, the names changed again and again. And by 1517, the people who are in power are a group called the Mamluks. For help with your timeline, for me, it helps to think about what else was going on in the world in 1517. A lot of times these names and these numbers, they just become too much. But in 1517, we are pretty early in the reign of Henry VIII in England. So that gives you an idea of maybe what else is going on in the world at the time. What else is going on with other religions at the time, which is actually pretty interesting. Europe finds itself in the middle of the Protestant Reformation. Well, in 1517, the Mamluks, who were controlling Egypt, they end up losing to the Ottoman Empire. That would be the same Ottoman Empire that was around until early in the 20th century. Well, so when the Ottomans took over Egypt, though part of the empire, they retained more autonomy than really any other part of the empire did. In fact, they were more like a vassal state. They were under the umbrella of the Ottomans. They were paying them lots of money, but they really governed themselves. With the exception of a three-year period between 1798 and 1801, when Egypt was part of Napoleon's empire, and you'll remember that Napoleon, it was his forces that found the Sphinx and found the Rosetta Stone. So it was an important 3 years, but with the exception of those 3 years, Egypt pretty much ruled itself. After Napoleon's involvement, the men who were in charge of Egypt, they started taking out massive loans from European banks, especially the British and the French. The Egyptian debt and European interest in the nation of Egypt simultaneously increased. It led to a European commission being formed to deal with Egypt's debt. Egypt's debt was so big that the Europeans said, hey, we will forgive Egypt's debt in exchange for control of the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal was really important for trade. Well, so this commission and this agreement that happened with Egypt led to even more European involvement in Egypt. And it also really started to increase the Egyptian people's frustration with the European involvement in their affairs. I would also note that this is when Egyptology, as we sort of classically picture it, as Europeans being down there leading digs, wearing lots of white linen clothes and pith helmets and black and white Boris Karloff mummies coming out of the sand. That sort of classic image of Egyptology, that's when it actually was born. That's when the Europeans were down there, I think, because they had interest in ancient Egypt and the history of it. They're going and they're finding awesome artifacts and bringing them back to their home countries and putting those artifacts in their own collections. But they're doing it more out of a sense of adventure and interest than a desire for scientific research. That changes over time, and Egyptology and the entire field of archaeology develops, thankfully, into what is actually a scientific endeavor. But in this time period in the late 19th century, this is that kind of Egyptology. This is the beginning of those sorts of expeditions. In 1914, Great Britain officially took over Egypt. That is when the broader Ottoman Empire joined the Central Powers and entered into what we call World War I. In 1914, Great Britain looked at Egypt and decided to make them into a protectorate. The Egyptian people were not wild about this arrangement, and they protested and they rebelled against the British forces who they rightfully saw as occupying their nation. Well, in 1922, Great Britain granted independence to what they called the Kingdom of Egypt. But British forces would remain in Egypt until 1952. And in 1952, there was a coup that was organized by a man named Gamal Abdel Nasser. Very important name, Nasser. That led to the creation of what we think of as today's Republic of Egypt. Although even that changed names a few times over the years, ultimately in 1952, you have Nasser and the people who were with him creating the Republic of Egypt. Nasser was a really popular leader in Egypt. He instituted something called Arab socialism, which blended socialism as we think of it today, also with Arab and Muslim values. When he entered office, he looked at a nation that he saw the top 6% of the entire citizenry of Egypt owning, I believe it's about 60% of all the land in the nation. And so he went and he instituted socialist rules that broke all of that, that had the goal of creating a larger middle class. These were the things that he did to bring more power to the Egyptian people. At least, ideally, that's what he was going for. Aside from the ways that he changed the structure of Egypt, he's also really known for the way that he interacted with the modern state of Israel. In May of 1967, he closed the Straits of Tehran to Israeli ships. And the state of Israel, prior to this happening, had announced that, hey, Egypt, if you ever do this to us, we are going to see this as a declaration of war from you. And so he did this. And over the next couple of weeks, tensions really increased between Israel and Egypt, and it led to a very famous battle called the Six-Day War. That happened June 5th through 10th of 1967. During this war, for these 6 days, Israel was simultaneously attacked by Egypt at the helm, but with their allies of Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Lebanon. In 6 days, Israel endured assaults from all of these. And in 6 days, Israel won and they more than doubled their territory. There were over 20,000 Arab casualties during the 6 days and fewer than 1,000 Israeli casualties. It was in this time that Israel seized the Golan Heights. They took them from Syria. They seized the West Bank from Jordan. They seized the West Bank, and that included East Jerusalem. And then they also took the Gaza Strip and, importantly, the entire Sinai Peninsula from Egypt. This was seen as a huge defeat for Nasser, and he died about 3 years later. His successor, Anwar Sadat, would eventually adopt a policy of negotiation with Israel. It didn't happen overnight, but it happened over time. And in 1977, so 10 years after the Six-Day War, Anwar Sadat, he actually went to Jerusalem, and he ended up in 1979 signing the Egypt-Israel Peace Treaty. And that was done with the help of America under President Carter. At home, Sadat started opening up the country, and he made economic reforms in Egypt that allowed for more capitalism and allowed for there to be more private investment, including more foreign investment in the country. In 1981, he was executed. He was assassinated by Islamic extremists who felt that he was pulling too far away from Arab socialism, and most importantly, that he was too kind to Israel. His successor was a man named Hosni Mubarak, and Mubarak, he continued Sadat's policies of opening up Egypt and negotiating with Israel. Today, Israel continues to really struggle with the Muslim Brotherhood. That is an organization that was founded in Egypt in 1928, but actually the Muslim Brotherhood is illegal, officially illegal within Egypt. It is a group. It is a terror organization. It is not a political party. It has done a lot over the years to make Israel's life more difficult, especially in Gaza. But when you think about Egypt, think about it separately from the Muslim Brotherhood, because the Muslim Brotherhood is not the state of Egypt. People who remember the Muslim Brotherhood may have been elected and may serve in power, but try to keep them separate in your mind. The modern state has actually done more than any other Arab nation to try to normalize relations with Israel. In my lifetime, and even before I was born, that was the case. Up until the Abraham Accords, Egypt was the only Arab nation that had any kinds of ties with Israel. Maybe that's ironic, or at the very least, it's incredibly poetic. When you think about the long, long history between Egypt, ancient and modern, and Israel, ancient and modern, Egypt had a very early, entirely necessary role in the development of Israel's religion and even their national identity. Egypt in the Bible is often Israel's foil. Without Egypt, without the Passover event, without the Exodus event, you don't have the scriptures laid out in the ways that they are. You don't have the Israelite religion, the Jewish religion, the Christian religion. You don't have Jesus going down to Egypt. It's all very intertwined. And I think it's so important for Bible readers and scripture lovers to understand all of the different ways that Egypt has been important to ancient Israel and even to modern Israel today. The The Red-Haired Archaeologist podcast is researched, hosted, and recorded by me, Amanda Hote Haley. It is sound edited by Nicholas Allaire. New episodes are released each Thursday. To interact with me and other listeners, make sure you click the follow button on the Red-Haired Archaeologist pages on Facebook and Instagram. Then check out my website at redhairedarchaeologist.com, where you can subscribe to my monthly email and book me to come speak in your town.